The great coastal rainforest of Western Canada, often called the Great Bear Rainforest, has been saved from devastating logging practices by an agreement. In the late 1990s and afterwards, under pressure from protests and commercial boycotts, the CEOs of the biggest logging companies agreed to meet face-to-face with negotiators from Greenpeace, Forest Ethics, the Sierra Club, and for a while the Rainforest Action Network. They quickly realized no deal would be made without the First Nations peoples living in the coastal communities. Almost none of the tribes had reached a treaty with the government who claimed the forests belonged to them. We have Amanda Carr on the line, who has represented Greenpeace in this deal. Amanda, there was some really good news over the last few days, but first, could you describe where this rainforest is and why we should care?
Sure. The Great Bear Rainforest stretches along the coast of BC, basically from the northern tip of Vancouver Island, if you were to draw a line straight across, and up to the Alaska border. It's the largest intact tract of coastal temperate rainforest found in the world, and it's an area that's sort of 6.5 million hectares in size. It's home to grizzly bears, black bears, a rare variety of black bear known as the spirit bear. It's a white genetic variety of black bear, as well as, you know, thousand-year-old towering red cedars, and it's absolutely spectacular and a precious place in the world.
It's one of those ancient forests that really can't be replaced. Some of those trees have been standing for thousands of years, if I understand it.
Yeah, it hasn't had any large disturbance since the last glaciation, which was 10,000 years ago. And in addition, it's home to First Nations communities who have also been there for over 10,000 years.
Wow. Well, it's my understanding the enviros went straight to the companies because the government of the day wouldn't respond to public concerns about the rampant logging in these ancient forests. Is it true to say this started out as a citizen process, which was really developed outside of government in the first stages?
Absolutely. As some of your listeners may know, Clackwit Sound was a place of large civil disobedience, the largest act of civil disobedience in Canadian history, with over 1,000 protesters arrested. And we still have problems in Clackwit Sound despite that large public outcry. So when the campaign moved into the Great Bear Rainforest, there were blockades, but those concerns were also taken to the marketplace. So around the world, we had activists that were targeting customers of forest products from the Great Bear Rainforest, and that's when we really started to see things shift.
It was unusual for CEOs in particular, but anybody from the logging companies to talk to environmentalists. But I suppose when the phone starts ringing and the customer in Japan or Europe says, well, we can't buy because it's ancient forests and our customers will object, that would bring some action.
It would. As many of us know, corporations often have to respond to the bottom line, and we started affecting the bottom line.
And American foundations have played a significant role in the success of this agreement. Why did they get involved in Canada, and what have they contributed?
I think really anybody who comes to the Great Bear Rainforest is captivated by the potential that exists there. Most of the communities in the Great Bear Rainforest are not doing the logging themselves. It's done by outsiders, and it provides such a magical combination of culture as well as the kinds of wildlife that we were talking about earlier. So I think it's captivating, and I think the solutions that began to be developed by Greenpeace, Forest Ethics, Sierra Club, as well as the logging companies, and then First Nations as well, became really compelling. So essentially, the logging corporations and environmentalists agreed to a protected areas network that covers one-third of the area, as well as commissioned independent science to develop new logging practices, and those are to be in place by 2009. And then the third piece of the puzzle was an innovative conservation investment package, so money for local First Nations communities to do things like manage the protected areas and start sustainable businesses like ecotourism. And I think the foundation saw the groundbreaking sort of all-encompassing solution that was being developed, and it was a very compelling initiative.
I suppose the First Nations people also had seen clear-cut logging destroying forests that were very important to their way of life. So in addition to the job investment, they'd want to keep things going for the next generations the way they had known it.
Absolutely. I mean, like any community, there's differing views within First Nations communities, but I think in large part the maintenance of their territory is a very deeply embedded cultural value.
So they had to be part of the deal for sure. Didn't the foundations contribute some serious money to this deal as well?
Yeah, just recently on Sunday we had the announcement of something that's called conservation financing. And the environmental community, largely spearheaded by the foundations as well as the American Nature Conservancy, raised $60 million for the initiative. And the province has committed $30 million. And then just recently on Sunday, the federal government of Canada came through with the final match of $30 million. So it's a total of $120 million for coastal communities.
And I realize this is a complex question, but roughly, where will some of that money go?
So I think half of it will be placed in an endowment in general. And off that interest, we'll see jobs created for things like managing the parks, stewardship of the lands, something called a watchman program, which is essentially paid guardians of the land so that they can go out and see what's happening in their traditional territory and report on it. The other half will be invested in sustainable businesses, so things like ecotourism, high-end fishing lodges, potentially non-timber forest products, so mushroom harvesting and maybe even herbal remedies. Those are the kinds of things we think it will seed.
Boy, you know, I kind of like the idea of paid watchmen. I could see that being applied well outside of this deal.
Absolutely. We still have one major challenge in the Great Bear Rainforest, and that's really shifting the logging practices. So a commitment exists to shift them by 2009. We're seeing a lack of momentum on that commitment by some, but I think it will be very helpful to have eyes and ears on the ground really stewarding their territory and making sure that the changes we all committed to are really happening.
I've heard about EBM. What is that?
So when we sort of sat down to talk, which happened essentially in 2001 is when it was really solidified, and that Greenpeace was able to sit down and talk because we'd placed moratorium in over 100 valleys, so those areas weren't being logged while we sat down to talk. And in return, we suspended our markets campaign, so suspended the request for boycott of forest products from the region. And jointly, we commissioned some independent science. So the logging industry put in money matched by the environmental organizations as well as government, and then it was co-managed by First Nations. And we sat down and asked the question of two questions, really. What needed to be left in protected areas, and then how would we shift logging practices outside the protected areas? And that recommendation of what should be left came in the range of between 40 and 60%. Now, the agreements that were announced only protect 33% from logging. So we obviously have a deficit there, and there's the need to shift logging practices. So independent of that, what was developed was something called the Ecosystem-Based Management Handbook. And it essentially describes how logging should take place. And it really is a system of planning. So in one watershed, you would do high-risk management, allowing you to do low-risk management in other watersheds. It's sort of a balancing of risk. So you could do light touch everywhere or do a little bit heavier logging in one area and leave other areas untouched.
And is that being applied right now on the coast?
It's not. Unfortunately, we still have status quo clear cut happening outside protected areas. And there's a real need for action on behalf of the companies to make these agreements real.
Well, we'll hope that that comes up. Now, on a more personal note, I can't help but noticing that many of the movers and shakers in this rainforest drama were women. And generally, they were meeting with male CEOs of companies and men as chiefs and leaders of the First Nations communities. Am I going too far on this emphasis on the role of women here, playing a role of peacemakers and getting a dialogue going between what were opposing camps?
Well, there were women on the front lines of the protests. Women like Tamara Stark, and there were women that also were able to sit down and talk. Catherine Stewart, Maren Smith, Lisa Mateus all come to mind. So absolutely, I think all of this work, it's fair to say, has been driven mostly by women in the Great Bear. But I think it has been a range of tactics. So potentially it is that diversity and that female characteristic that was able to come up with some innovative solutions, but in addition, able to take some hard lines when they needed to be taken.
And have you heard from other groups in other parts of the world who are looking at this agreement as a model of how they could resolve their problems?
Absolutely. I mean, Greenpeace is looking at this for the other six magnificent forests that we're working on, in large part recognizing that the attention was needed to be brought to bear, so the conflict served its purpose, absolutely. And the markets campaigns were critical in making that shift. And then really what it has led to in terms of model, because you can't just cookie-cutter approach. You can't take the EBM that was developed for the Great Bear Rainforest and necessarily apply it elsewhere. But what's really proving to be the model is the model of process. So the fact that we placed moratorium on areas allowed us to be more constructive and engage proactively in finding solutions.
You know, this gives me some hope because we're finding out that it took a long time, but the protests and the people who did care very deeply about these forests, at least we've got part of the coast, part of the wildness, can I say semi-protected and on its way to being protected.
Absolutely. And I mean, 33%, if we look sort of globally, really is a high percentage of protection. It's similar to the Great Barrier Reef protection, which is world-renowned, similar percentage to places like Costa Rica. So we really are seeing a model. And when ecosystem-based management is applied by 2009, I think the world really will have a shining beacon to look at.
And beyond getting the better logging, is there other work that remains to be done, or can you just go home and sit in the easy chair?
Oh, I wish. There were 107 protected areas committed to. We have 24 of them legislated, so there's still the need to see that legislation through, which I don't have any concerns about, but just sort of seeing that process through. And then, you know, the funding's in place, but clearly communities on the coast and the investors themselves have some work to do to make sure that that money really seeds a different conservation-based economy in the Great Bear Rainforest.
So we should keep our eye on this West Coast wilderness and make sure everybody keeps to the deal. Amanda Carr of Greenpeace, thanks a lot for talking with Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
This is EcoShock Radio. All environment, all the time. Get more info on the web at ecoshock.org.